Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Atheist Experience. We are live today. It's Sunday, July 12, 2020. I'm your host, Matt Delaney. Joining me this week, my very good friend, Seth Andrews.
Hey, how are you? Good to see you, my friend. My brother too. In heathenry.
Yes. And how are you holding down during the global pandemic? And
you know, it's weird. I don't know if you've had this conversation, but I almost feel guilty because when you work from home, it hasn't affected me in the way that it has negatively affected so many other people. So I almost feel like, we're not doing conventions and I miss, hanging out with everybody. But at the same time, I work from home. I feel like I'm cheating a little bit. So it's been all right. I sure do look forward to the opportunity we can all physically be in the same space and hang out, right?
So. Yeah, I work from home too, and it's been, I think the loneliness, the inability to connect with people has been the biggest issue, and there were a couple of days where I was like, I stream games on Twitch, and that gives me a chance to talk to people. I do the show and then have interactions.
I'm interested in how we've adapted. Right. How will COVID change permanently how we do what we do? Because, a lot of these organizations, businesses, whatever, are now discovering they can satellite out their people who can work from home with a dog in their lap. What I'm saying? Yeah. And when bare feet next to the refrigerator, and they can do what they do without having to, pay the overhead and worry about the building. And like, how is what we're doing now going to change the world for the decades ahead? And I'd be curious. It's an interesting social experiment, I think.
So. Yeah. Well, we can talk about that a little bit. We got a bunch of callers to get to, but I've got announcements to make first to get everything sorted. We are, of course, live. We are no longer in the studio, in the building, the ACA Freethought Library here in Austin, Texas. And so we're doing everything remotely, which means I'm at home. Seth is coming to us from his home. Any of my regular co-hosts are coming to us from their homes. And because of that, a number of things have changed, which I'm going to remind people about. The telephone number to call in, which you'll see at the bottom of your screen, is 512-991-9242. Or if you're on your computer, you can go to tiny.cc/callAXP. And that will allow you to make a call from your computer to get in. We're no longer using the old number, the voice over IP number for the system at the building. So if you just looked at an old video and saw the number there and are like, I keep dialing a number and I can't get through, that's the reason why. Because of that also, there's various audio issues, although we have a crack team of amazing superhuman individuals, which I'll get to in just a couple minutes. But that means that it takes a little longer to put somebody on hold. I'm going to try to do a better job of making use of the hold button. Everything's on a slight delay, and that can be incredibly frustrating. Don't read frustration with a problem with a conversation as if we're angry or mad at anybody, because that's just not the case. If you're watching us live on YouTube right now, instead of super chats and stuff like that, if you look directly above the chat, you'll see a donation link. And that is what we're using now instead of the super chats, because 100% of the donations that you make while watching the live stream today on YouTube will go to the Atheist Community of Austin, a nonprofit educational corporation promoting positive atheism and the separation of religion and government. Let me get back to the old school announcements. In addition to the donation button at the top, there's also merchandise that's available and a graphic we can put up there. You can go to bit.ly/AENmerch for coffee cups, t-shirts, and other stuff like that. You can also become a member on the YouTube channel, or you can support us at patreon.com/theatheistexperience. And while we're doing this, and this has been an interesting exercise, because I'm going to get back to talking with Seth about this. We have an amazing crew. I'm going to put up the crew cam. We'll talk about them for ages. Yes, there's a cat that secretly runs everything from a headquarters in Vern's office. But we've got call screeners. We've got Greg's doing the video production, and Vern's watching the audio. We're so happy for everybody who's voluntary to make what could have been a difficult time that seriously impacted the show actually kind of a highlight, because not only do I get to have people on like Seth, and next week we have another special guest next week, my friend Scott Clifton, otherwise known on YouTube as Theoretical Bullshit, or maybe you've seen him as the Emmy Award winning soap opera actor. But Scott's going to be here with us next week. This week, Jenna had to take a personal day, and I reached out, and Seth was like, yep, I'll do it. So you have a book that's getting ready to come out like next month. Is that right?
Yeah, I've been waiting for the official release, but I'm doing a pre-order thing. I will shamelessly plug it, because I'm going to pull the plug on this at any second. But the book is called Confessions of a Former Fox News Christian. I get into the origins of Fox News, Roger Ailes, kind of where he comes from. He has a fascinating backstory that has a lot to do with sort of GOP evangelical conservative activism. And that stems back all the way to the Nixon administration. So, you know, before he took the reins in 96, he had already been primed to sort of propagandize these Republican, evangelical Republican talking points. We get into right-wing radio. We get into the gun culture here in the United States. We get into God and country, American exceptionalism, the founding fathers, the abortion debates, the gay agenda, which is something I heard a lot of when I was a devout believer, and sort of reverse engineering all of this to sort of understand how it operates. And then, you know, for me to be able to go back and see it from the other end of the looking glass. So the book will be on Amazon, hardcover, paperback. There will be an audible.com version where I narrate. The book runs just under 8 hours in audio form. You can listen to the introduction right now for free, and you can pre-order, which means I'll autograph it just for you. Anyway, well, almost any way you want it autographed at sethandrews.com. If you are watching this in archive, there's a good chance the pre-order autographed may be over, but you can still link to it at sethandrews.com. And you have my thanks for your support. I'm excited about it. Honestly, the Fox News culture, Matt, it's a cult.
Yeah.
Right? It's a cult. And I used to be that guy. I listened to Rush. I read Ann Coulter. I loved Glenn Beck. I watched Sean Hannity. I was that guy.
I was a Rush Limbaugh ditto head. I wonder if you could just like vamp for two or three more minutes so I can go to sethandrews.com and order my copy I'd like you to autograph. I'll do it after the show.
Just stop.
No, so, you know, we were talking about how this has changed. And I do think this is going to be something. I hope that this fundamentally changes the world in a positive way, because there are a lot of people who've been working from home for a long time. Some businesses were a little more forward thinking about it. Others were like, oh, I don't know, it wouldn't work for us. I can't count the number of times where I had a job where it absolutely would have been perfectly acceptable for me to work from home. And they're like, no, we're not going to do that. I think we're going to see a lot more of that, because ultimately they're going to look at how it costs less. You know, if you don't have to rent an office and have, you know, desks and electricity and, you know, all these other things that you're going to have there for the people, and instead just parcel that money out so that people can work from home, because obviously you're still going to need to supply equipment and, you know, you might be picking up the internet bill for, you know, employees and stuff like that. But we're finding that there's a lot more we can do remotely than anybody suspected, including medical conferencing about issues and things like that. You know,
I think it was the American Humanist Association did an online conference. Now, I'm of two minds. I understand that they did the online conference before COVID, but they did it to sort of reduce costs so people didn't have to get on a plane. They could watch. And I participated in online gatherings. I just did an online speech for the Fellowship of Freethought Dallas. I did a presentation called America is Not a Christian Nation. That will soon be available on my YouTube channel. But and I get that, and I like it. But I also think there will continue to be, there needs to be in-person connection, like we're communal creatures. And so
I will die. Like it, like right now, Austin is on lockdown till August 15th. I used to say that I've been alone many times before and that I'm good with it. Turns out that's not true. Turns out all those times that I thought that I had been alone for a long period of time, I still had a roommate, or I still was able to go out and interact with people, or I still had a friend that I could go talk to and get a hug. I had a good friend of mine come over to the house just a day or so ago. And basically it was, we're going to wear our masks and sit out in the garage 10 feet away just to visit and catch up with each other and have zero contact. And how hard it is to just not hug somebody who you care about and are desperate to for any kind of contact. It's worse for people, I think, who are single or, you know, don't have anybody else in their quarantine in their house with them. Although you never know. There are probably some people who are discovering cohabitating during a quarantine.
Get me the hell out of here.
Yeah, it's like, yeah, this is not working.
I can't live with this person. I want out. I'm sure there have been a few of those instances.
And I don't think it's a fair test of any, like, interaction, really.
This is not everybody in the same physical space. And
yeah. the world is upside down and we're in a global pandemic and there's 20 times the stress that you would normally have in anything. This is, if your relationship survives quarantine, you're probably good.
Have you noticed how badass the masks are becoming out there? Now, I mean, we have, I still have questions about efficacy and filtration and all those things. All right, fine. I mean, but there are some badass masks that people are smart enough to market and sell and promote and make from home. And so when I look around here in Red State, Oklahoma, I don't know, are you catching this in Texas where you're getting a lot of the freedom fighters saying, I'm not going to have my liberties taken away. I refuse to wear a mask.
And I'm Texas, like, Texas and Florida are way worse than Oklahoma.
Are they?
Oh, yeah.
God. Well, I mean, I just think to myself, what's the problem? I mean, there's some badass accessories that you could have and, you know, you could go out and rock it. You know, you could rock it.
Which reminds me, I want to say a quick thank you to my ex-wife who accidentally sent me a nice pumpkin mask that she had ordered, which I actually like and wear frequently. And there's a fan of the show who lives in Kansas City, and because I'm originally from Kansas City, sent me a nice Kansas City Royals mask. And so while I don't really follow the Royals anymore, I'm still, you know, I guess a fan. And so I've got that mask as well. You want to get to some calls here and see what some people have to say?
I'm all yours. Whatever you need. Let's
do it. All right. We're going to start off. We're going to throw caution to the wind because we've got Jonathan in Michigan who claims to have solid proof of God. So how you doing, Jonathan? You're on with Seth Andrews, the host of The Thinking Atheist, and Matt Dilanti.
Doing good. How are you guys?
I'm holding in there.
So I have some evidence for the Bible. If you look at the records for the past few years, there have been some archaeologists that found Jesus's tomb. And I think another person discovered his cross is still standing. So I want to know what you guys think of that. I think that's some pretty good evidence.
You think that's pretty good evidence? So you think somebody actually found Jesus' tomb and that Jesus' cross is still standing? Can you tell me any more about this? Did you bother to look up to see if the thing that you heard on the internet is even true? Because it's not.
Yeah, I did look into it. It can't be disproven, so I don't see why it would be false.
What do you mean it can't be disproven? It's not true. The statement is someone discovered Jesus's tomb. That's not true. It's not true until somebody actually identifies and we have sufficient evidence to conclude that that's the case. So it's not true. It's also not true that Jesus's cross is still standing. So, you know, the fact that somebody claims something like that, I mean, there's very little I can say here other than you read something on the internet and that's not enough. What is the evidence for this?
I'm waiting on a specific source. Like a guy once said, and I heard the words, I think. These are not really the declarations rooted in evidence. I'd like to know, who's your source specifically? Who found this stuff and where geographically can we find them?
I'm not sure who exactly found this evidence, but it was discovered in Jerusalem. And I'd go on faith instead of evidence.
Okay, well, we're not interested in that. We're not interested in people who are just going to take stuff on faith because could I just take it on faith that you're wrong and that there is no God and that white people are superior to black people and that men are superior to women? Could I take all of those things on faith?
Maybe. It depends on context.
What do you mean maybe? Couldn't I just, you say that you don't care about evidence, you only take it on faith, and I'm saying, couldn't I believe those things based on faith without evidence? Isn't that possible?
No.
It's not possible for me just to believe that men are superior to women based on faith without evidence. That's not possible.
I guess I'll have to think about that a little bit.
You probably should. You should probably think about several other things because at this point, what we care about is evidence. You called in specifically. The call screener says here, you are aware of solid proof of God, historic evidence, and now you tell us you don't care about evidence. You're just taking it on faith. Are you even serious, Jonathan? Did you just call in to hear yourself talk on the TV and you're just making shit up?
No, I thought the Bible would be good evidence for God, and since he's
already no, you didn't talk about the Bible, though. You think that? Do you really think that a 2,000-year-old wooden cross is still standing somewhere, and that nobody that this had to be discovered?
Well, I'd have to go see it for myself, but I think I'm going to trust the archaeologists on this.
Okay, first of all, you don't even know that you're trusting an archaeologist or that any archaeologist reported this. I'm asking you a very simple question. Let's assume that Jesus's cross has been standing this entire time. Do you really think this is something that would have had to been discovered? You don't think people would have been pointing to this for the last 2,000 years saying, yep, that's Jesus' cross. That's it. There it is right there on that hill, Golgotha. Hey, we know where this happened. Jesus' cross right there. You think this had to be discovered?
That's actually a pretty good point. I didn't think about.
Yeah. What do you think the likelihood that a 2,000-year-old piece of wood, that if it actually happened, and if so, we don't even know that Jesus existed. We don't know that he was crucified. What
do you think? If the cross defied 2,000 years of, you know, deterioration, weathering, insects, yeah, let's say that this is the most hardy wood. All right, fine. If that existed and you could prove it was Christ's cross, there would already be like a bed and breakfast built, or right, like there would be an entire, like, we know that the Holy Lands is already sort of a tourist mecca around the story of Jesus. But we know that if Jesus's tomb had been discovered and the cross had been verified, that it would make Las Vegas look like Bug Shooter, Oklahoma. You know what I'm saying? This would be like Mecca. People would have come and it would have been this big thing.
Not only that.
You invoke archaeologists without giving any specific names, credentials, peer review.
This is why we can't take you seriously.
It's literally dissipating. The words are just disappearing as they come out of your mouth. We're going to need more. Okay.
I tell you what, Jonathan, have you got a web browser open?
No, I do not at the moment.
And so anybody in the world, if you go to Google right now and you type in, is Jesus's cross still standing? The first result is about a cross of Jesus tornado still stands after a tornado hits Texas. Then it's all about that. There's nothing do you think that if Jesus' cross was still standing and you typed into Google, is Jesus' cross still standing, that you would get results about a tornado striking a cross of Jesus in Oklahoma or Dallas instead of the actual cross of Jesus? Like, you need to work on your Google foo a little bit. So when you hear something on the internet, first of all, let me give you some tips. Go to Snopes, SNOPES.com, because that's a good debunking site. Type your question that you want, the evidence that you think you have, into Google and just see what kind of results it get, because it's not realistic. Now, nobody's found Jesus's tomb. There are people who think they have or haven't. How would you ever, let's say we found a tomb. Jonathan, how would you demonstrate that it's Jesus's? Do we have any DNA to compare?
DNA's, as far as I'm concerned, we have no evidence for that.
We have no evidence for DNA?
Well, we can't see it. So how do we know that it exists?
So hang on. Are you talking about DNA just in general? You don't believe that DNA exists, or are you talking about we don't have Jesus's DNA?
I'm not saying that I don't believe it exists. We just don't have evidence for it because we can't see it.
So you don't think sequencing the human genome ever happened?
No.
Okay. Well, then you should write to Francis Collins, the former head of the Human Genome Project, who, by the way, is a Christian and believes in Christ because he saw a waterfall frozen into three. But he has argued on behalf of this. And right now you're just in a position where you called us and said you had evidence. Then you said you take everything on faith. And on faith now, you're writing off DNA. You're writing off the entirety of genetics because you think you can't see it. Jonathan, I'm gonna show how much respect that I have for you and most people on the planet. I think you're full of shit. I think you're making stuff up right now and calling in just to see how long you can do this and make it go along. Because I genuinely don't encounter people who say, I don't care about evidence, I just take things on faith. And DNA, I'm not gonna believe that because we can't see it. I find you beyond ridiculous. So thanks for calling.
Thank you, guys.
You do this every week.
I don't do that every week. It's just, it's just really frustrating. As a matter of fact, I almost never do that.
I totally get it. I mean, I know that occasionally you get some off the wall stuff, but you know, we just bounced around to so many odd places in the course of 10, 12 minutes. The idea that Christ's tomb, you're right. I mean, how in the world would you even ever verify that it was the tomb of Christ? When he was talking about the cross, I was reminded of an old X-Files episode where the cross was actually embedded in the stone of a wall or building, as I recall, and they broke it open, and whoever carried the cross or the remnant of the cross into battle, even in the modern day, would be invincible. And I remember thinking, wow, you know, that'd be a great story. But of course, there's no evidence for the cross.
And then they hear that throughout history. People have been selling splinters supposedly from the original cross. I mean, that used to happen all the time. You know, we're going to sell these religious artifacts, including splinters from the cross. If Jesus' cross had been standing there, it would have to be like protected to keep people from going up and taking splinters off of it. And the tomb, it's like, how do you tell the tomb? But the problem here with Jonathan is, on occasion, we will get prank callers. We're getting fewer and fewer, but I could be wrong. And it's very rare that I just call someone out like that. But first of all, he was willing to listen and not interrupt. That makes me suspect that he isn't in fact calling to defend anything that he actually believes. That's already a problem. The second thing is the sort of flawed thinking that someone would have in order to just say, hey, I've got evidence. I don't care about evidence. I'm taking it on faith. I heard some archaeologists found Jesus' tomb and a cross. The degree to which a brain has to be broken to accept all that means it's unlikely you would be able to find the phone number for this show and call it. So I'm pretty sure that was just a punk prank call.
My favorite cross story is those cats in the Philippines that have themselves crucified every single year, yeah, right, to show their gratitude to God. And the whole time I'm thinking, have you even read your Bible? Right. The whole idea of the blood atonement was you don't have to get pinned up every freaking Easter. There's one guy that's done it for 30 years.
Yeah. You wrote about that in Sacred Cows, didn't you?
I wrote about the, I got a whole book. It's called, it's got Jesus. It's an artist illustration of Jesus holding out three nails. And he said, hey, can you put me up for the night? Which is an old gag. But, I don't really understand. You know, when you think about the cross and what it represents in terms of human suffering and torture, that's where we get the word excruciating. It actually comes from the word crucifixion. Yep. Talk about this sort of unimaginable, indescribable pain and agony that you would suffer. And the idea now that people are wearing this around their necks and, you know, their earrings, t-shirts, bumper stickers with the cross, with this execution, torture, execution method, to me just seems so bizarre. It didn't when I was a believer. It certainly does now.
It didn't when I was a believer either. And actually, I listened to Bill Hicks, and one of my favorite routines from Bill Hicks was talking about all these Christians walking around with crosses on their necks. And it'd be like going up to Jackie O with like a little rifle pendant on your neck. Just thinking of John, Jackie, just thinking of John.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's one of my favorite bits from Bill Hicks because it really is. There's kind of this death cult thing to this that it's just, you know, if you think about religions like Christianity, et cetera, what you've got is blood magic, although it's kind of disguised. It's not too well disguised because, you know, when they give them cures for, I think a cure for leprosy or something where you end up having to kill a bird and let the blood drip and do all this other stuff. So there's still blood, just raw blood stuff in there, but it's not any different from the blood magic that was used in various other, you know, animistic religions and shamanistic religions. It's just that at some point, while God really loves a good barbecue, he decided, hey, let's just barbecue Jesus once so we can stop barbecuing animals every weekend.
Yeah, blood magic describes the crucifixion. I mean, you just described the crucifixion.
Yep.
I don't know. A lot of that Old Testament stuff freaks me out. Like the two goats, right? You take one goat and you transfer the sins of the tribe into the goat, and then you take it off into the wilderness to starve to death, presumptively. That's called the escape or scapegoats, where we get the word. And then the second goat, well, now it's full of sin as well. So you execute it so that the aroma of the blood and flesh and whatever will please God. I mean, it's just disturbing.
A similar thing with chickens. But actually, that's going to take us in a way.
Sorry, I went off on a tangent.
No, the perfect segue to our next caller in a way, even though I hadn't thought about it that way. Steven in Chicago had a question for us. Welcome, Steven. You're on with Seth and Matt.
Hi, Matt. Hi, Seth. How are you?
Doing well.
Doing all right.
I was, born Judeo-Hard, brought up Jewish, and my parents were not, you know, I was brought up Reformed, so we weren't really, really Jewish, you know, like not really heavily religious, but both my parents passed away. I have a 10-year-old son, and I thought, you know, before I actually just started watching your show about 2 weeks ago, and it kind of opened up my eyes a little bit, and I want to thank you for that. But, I thought it would be the right thing because my mom was from Israel, and she always said to, respect, you know, the traditions of the Jewish people and what they've gone through and everything like that. And so, you know, I just thought it would be good for my son to go to Jewish school and, you know, get bar mitzvah and all the other stuff that, you know, a normal Jewish person would do. But, you know, watching your show and stuff, I started questioning whether that's really the right thing to do for my son. He's on the autism spectrum. He's high functioning, but he's, you know, so it's, I don't even know if I can really ask him that kind of thing, whether he gets anything out of it or not. But, I was just wondering what your thoughts are on, you know, sending your son, you know, he goes like, you know, twice a week on Sunday, he does, you know, just history, Jewish history, and, you know, learning about the Jewish people and stuff like that. On Wednesday, he goes to Hebrew school to learn Hebrew so that he can do the bar mitzvah thing. So, I mean, it's not like I don't view it as much indoctrination as maybe like Orthodox or even conservative Jewish people or, you know, I don't know much about the Christian religion too much. So I don't know. I can't really
What do you think, Seth? I mean, we've talked about this. You and I both talked about this from the standpoint of like Christianity quite often. I don't know how many times you've addressed it with regard to Judaism.
Well, I think that's what he's asked is part of the question. But in my mind, I'm asking another question, which tacks on to the end of it. What are we talking about when we say Jewish education? Because more than half of practicing Jews, at least here in the United States, but I think it's actually worldwide, either doubt supernatural things or don't believe outright. Like they are secular Jews, certainly not Orthodox. Mm-hmm. And yeah,
my dad was, you know, born in 1917, and, you know, as I said, he's passed away, but, you know, he was probably a atheist before it was like, even like one would admit that you're an atheist. And he always, you know, viewed science. He was a dentist. He always taught me, you know, the scientific methods. I mean, he was a good influence on that.
Judaism was like a cultural framework for his life, right? He enjoyed the traditions. He enjoyed the history. He may have enjoyed the music, the ritual of it. The window dressing of Judaism he enjoyed, despite the fact that he didn't really hold a God belief. Would that be accurate?
It was more my mom. I don't think my dad, you know, just went along with her because, you know, as I said, my mom was from Israel. So he just, you know, accepted because he didn't really have any opinion one way or the other.
Well,
my mom wasn't really religious either. She just, again, she wanted to, you know, just, you know, teach me about the Jewish history and teach me a little bit Hebrew so I can do the bar mitzvah and stuff like that.
The difference between teaching someone about Jewish history and maybe using, like, I'm in this weird space, Stephen, where I see the utility of religion in a few ways. I think that tradition, communal music, doesn't have to be called religious in exercise. But I understand the attraction. And so if somebody wants to be a secular Jew and they want to have the bar mitzvah and they want to enjoy the music and dress the dress and have the culture and the food and whatever, without all the supernatural backstory, I think tradition and ritual can provide much of the color for the human experience. The difference is we have to ask, is this merely a cultural exercise where he can get a good education, learning the history of the Jewish people as part of a comparative religions exercise, learning about all religions and none, or are they telling him what to think, teaching him to believe a literal Torah and getting into the superstitious aspect of it? Because if they're telling him that, then they're really programming him as to what to think. So the question really for me is this sort of a tradition exercise? Is it window dressing? Is it a framework? Do you get to help inform that, to give context, to make sure that they're not being indoctrinated?
Yeah, or what's going on in the school?
I'm sorry, go ahead, Matt.
No, I was just saying, yeah, I was adding on to that. Basically, what's going on? Because like we all know Judaism comes in different flavors. And so Reform Judaism doesn't even require a belief in a God. And I know a number of Reform Jews who practice it as more of like a cultural thing. There's also the Society for Humanistic Judaism, which I've met. I've been to a temple of that. I would recommend that you talk to a rabbi that is associated with the Society for Humanistic Judaism and perhaps a Reform rabbi to have them address how important they think it is for you to get your son this education. I have no problem at all with somebody learning about religion, learning about many different religions. Certainly have no problem with somebody learning other languages and history. So it's not a big deal unless the school is basically teaching the Jews are God's chosen people and there's this and this and this. And, you know, that if it is more closer to like conservative, Orthodox, Hasidic teachings, then I don't think it's the same as what you'd get in humanistic Judaism or Reform Judaism.
And if anybody reaches for a live chicken, that's probably a good reason to turn it, because he brought up the chicken earlier. there's a tradition among Orthodox Jews where they transfer the sin in their heart to that of a live chicken. And then they take the chicken by the poor thing. They take the chicken and they flip it around over their head and say some incantation. And then they take a razor blade and they cut the head off the chicken. So they've now had blood atonement using the chicken. And then they give the chicken to poor people to eat. And I always had the question, if you give somebody a chicken that's full of evil and they eat it, do they then require a fresh chicken to have? I'm sorry, I totally left the rails there, Matt.
it's chicken inception.
I'm sorry. I just thought that was just so. So I honestly, I would go deeper. Let's find out, is this a cultural exercise or is it a superstitious exercise?
I think the takeaway, Stephen, right now, and I'll turn this over to you and you can tell us what you think, but I think the takeaway right now from both of us is that neither of us are opposed to people learning about anything in an academic sense. And we certainly are both familiar with and understand why someone would view Judaism from a cultural angle and want their child to know about that history. But it's not free of concerns. And I'd recommend, you know, like I did, talking with a reform rabbi and perhaps one that's associated with the Society for Humanistic Judaism.
I believe it's mainly a cultural thing. I don't think I don't think they really push any specific agenda. As I said, it is a reform synagogue.
You're still there, right? You haven't handed that. They're not parenting for you. So at the end of the day, you still get to provide context. You still get to sort of make sure that what they're getting is presented as part of a larger framework, as you are teaching him what to think or how to think rather, right, and not what to think. You know, I think you have to be a participant. I wouldn't recommend handing him off and then you get him back later and go, well, I hope you did great. I think you need to be a participant in that process.
That's a good thing to think about. I'll definitely try to be more involved. It's hard when I'm a single parent, so it's a little bit harder for me with a job and everything, but I'll definitely try to be more involved in his upbringing with his Jewish history. So
absolutely.
Thank you.
Well, thanks a lot for the call, Stephen. And by the way, you can feel free to call us back sometime. Let us know how it's going. And if you think you need other, if maybe you're not comfortable going to a particular rabbi, if you think you need other help, we can always recommend recoveringfromreligion.org. And also, I recommend looking into Parenting Beyond Belief, which is something that we've been associated with for a number of years now. As a potential resource, it tends to be directed, not intentionally, but it tends to be directed in the United States towards Christians. But I think there's a lot of good resources and a lot of good people that you're going to find along those lines that'll offer you their advice and what worked for them and what didn't work for them.
Thank you, Stephen.
All right. Thank you. Thank you so much. Sure. Thank you.
It's hard for me, Matt. I'm a non-parent. I got stepkids, but I've never, but you know what? I was raised indoctrinated in private religious schools. And, I feel like I can speak to how programming works, this sort of weird reinforcement culture, this weird normal that happens in a lot of religious schools. And if I had been given comparative religions information, if they had said, all right, not this is what they teach and it's true, this is what so-and-so teaches and it's false. But if they just laid them out side by side, all right, here's the deity, here's their holy book, here's their basic beliefs, here's their mission statement, here's how they started, here's their worshipers, here's their heaven, here's their hell. If they had done that religion by religion, I'll bet I would have become an atheist a whole lot sooner,
You'd think so, except that I took a comparative religions course just exactly like that in ninth grade. And I can genuinely remember sitting there going, wow, all these other people believe in really weird shit. I'm glad that I was raised in the true religion. That's what the indoctrination and the teaching does, so that you don't see the problem with yourself and with what you believe there.
If you see the sinner that Matt has become, then that's why he needs at least two chickens. Yes. Like, you could not just have one chicken to atone for his sins. I'm just saying.
And that's why I go to Pluckers. All right. Let's see. We've got Matthew in North Carolina talking about, I'm not completely sure I understand this, Matthew. Tell us, you're calling about the God placebo effect that's given your dad some strength?
Correct. I appreciate you taking my call. Sure. Watched you for several years now. Thank you, Seth and Matt. Back in late 2015, my father was diagnosed with bone cancer. Early 2016, he had some procedure done. He died on the table for a little bit. They brought him back. And at that moment, they told my mom and my dad that he wouldn't be here come Christmas 2016. My wife and I at the time were building a house. And with that information, we decided to put a bedroom and a bathroom downstairs so that when my father passed, that my mom would come and live with us. Well, I believe that through his faith, it has allowed him to kind of carry on, take some experimental procedures, and he is now still around pushing 4 years later. And I guess I just wanted to get your both of your takes on that. I guess for lack of a better word, I just wanted to call it the God placebo effect that I think, but through his faith, that he kind of got the inner strength to keep pushing on and keep surviving rather than giving up.
I'm kind of confused because you said he was taking experimental treatments, and why aren't we crediting the experimental treatments instead of the God?
No, I think his point was, is that the hope that he got from his faith prompted him to pursue solutions and led him into seeking experimental treatments. Did I read that right?
Yes. Yeah, because he had bone cancer and they didn't think he'd be around for Christmas of 16. And I think it is through his faith that it kind of pushed him to try and be here a little bit longer rather than just sit and say, well, I'm doomed, and take whatever fate happened to him.
It kept him from giving up.
Kind of your feedback on this. Correct. Like, oh, I'm going to die. Yeah, there's nothing I can do. And I think his faith gave him strength to push on.
First of all, we know that placebos, that there is a placebo effect. In fact, some studies have shown that placebos affect people 30%. But what we're talking about here isn't a placebo effect. You're essentially saying his faith led him to want to stay here longer, and this had him pursue experimental treatments, and now he's been here for several years longer than was anticipated. The problem is, what faith has he got? What religious view does he have? Because if I knew that I was terminal and about to go to heaven, why would I want to stay here?
I think for the family, you know, I was actually raised Catholic as well. And so he is a devout Catholic, and at least we were raised that family is extremely important.
Yeah, but is it more important than God? And doesn't God have a plan?
You'd have to ask him that, but I was just wondering what you thought about people gaining strength through religion.
I honestly, the reason I'm making this point is because I don't think that's as much the case as people suspect. I suspect what keeps anybody, like if anybody with a terminal diagnosis, what keeps them wanting to continue living is A, the connections that they have with people who are here alive, which has nothing to do with religion. B, the general desire and the programming of our ancestors to have us do the sorts of things that encourage our survival as a secondary source. And quite frankly, I don't know that, depending on the nature of religion, I mean, it's one of those things like maybe, you know, if you had, well, you're not allowed to kill yourself because God will, you know, send you to hell then. And if God put doctors here and gave them medical treatment, you're supposed to do that. This is a hardship. You can make those kind of arguments. But I think that it's really being human and wanting to stay alive that is probably the biggest factor in someone seeking treatment. And I think that religion is more likely to make some people give up comfortably than fight to stay.
Okay.
I don't know. Don't you find, though, that people with a heaven belief, believers in the afterlife, are often the ones you find that are most afraid of death? I mean, I found a lot of people, and they talk wistfully about heaven and eternity and joy and bliss and perfection and color and music. But when it comes down to it, they're terrified of dying. They live fearful lives. They lock their doors and load their handguns and those types of things. So, you know, my experience has not been that, you know, somebody who is faced with death in the framework of God belief is comforted by heaven. I think that's a story that they often tell themselves. There may be a measure of comfort, But when the chips are down, you know, their survival instincts are as strong as anybody else. They want to live. Now, what's harder for me, Dr. Andy Thompson's done, he's a psychiatrist and author and activist. He's done a lot of writing about the placebo effect. And this is harder for me. Someone's in the hospital and you go and you put your hand on them, you know, you grab them by the hand and you, there's the act of praying, the scenario that causes, in many cases, a physiological change, like a brain chemistry change, because they are having an experience, call it prayer, call it whatever. And it's driven by God belief. Like they literally think they are being imbued with supernatural whatever. If that produces an actual physiological result, is there merit to the action, even if it's rooted in a lie? That's harder for me. I tend to think that we shouldn't have to lie to ourselves in order to give comfort and motivate people to press on and press through. I think the ill consequences, the negative consequences of embracing superstition far outweigh any of the benefits. And I think that the motivation, inspiration that your father's receiving, when it all boils down to it, no matter what the window dressing says, are likely, as Matt said, rooted in human beings, the things that we don't need the superstitious backstory for.
I'm reminded of the statement from Weinberg, which is normally used in a different context, which is, without religion, good people would do good things and bad people would do bad things. And it takes something like religion to get good people to do bad things. And I think there's a way to twist that or adjust it for this. And that is, there's some segment of the population that, faced with a terminal diagnosis, are going to fight to stay alive. And it's, you know, without any influence from a religion. And there are others who are going to give up. And there's some portion that could go either way. And I think that the case could be made that religion, particularly versions of Christianity, could easily be manipulated to get someone to give up or fight. But that by and large, the people who are likely to, it's really hard to get someone who would be a fighter in that circumstance to give up without appealing to something like religion.
But let's say you're in the hospital and you're at least a marginal believer. And I come in and I pray for you. We have that, like, a very personal experience, and I'm showing compassion. I'm participating in an exercise which has an end goal of you being restored and healed. You feel that you are given attention, you are given love, you are given all these things. And so there may be a physiological change somehow. What if it actually motivates you to keep on kicking? I think maybe his question, Matthew, would your question be, is there some utility in the exercise itself, even if it's not true? Would that be accurate?
Yeah, and I just wanted to get you guys' feedback. On a side note, I have not come out to my father. And the irony of this whole pandemic is the conversations my sister and I have had back and forth. I found out maybe 2 months ago, she's an atheist too.
Isn't that wild to think you're the only person in a family? Yeah. And it kind of reminds me, because it happened to me once or twice too. Sorry, I'm not going to be outing my other family members, but it's one of the things, like first starting to date someone, or when you're interested, so you're like, toss some things out as like, hey, what do you think? Are you into we do the same thing with intellectual stuff. It's like, I'm on the outside as an atheist, so I'm going to maybe drop some hints that maybe I'm this. And then all of a sudden, boom, the floodgates open.
Now, one thing I have used on my father is, he's an Italian, so he's got a nice temper, even at his age. He'll be 86 in a few weeks. And he will get very elevated in his temper. And one thing I come back to him, and I will say, that is not very Christian-like. And he calmed down.
You know, let me recommend a book to you. It's called Why We Believe in God. It's a small book, paperback, by Dr. Andy Thompson, Thomson. You can digest it in an evening, if that. And he gets into a lot of this sort of how we experience. I think one of the examples I've heard him use is communal music. When people come together in church, I'll start there, and they join hands and they sing songs together, there's actually a physiological change. There's something that changes, and we are affected physically by it as human beings. And this makes the worship experience in church very, very powerful, right? The endorphins are rushing, the emotions are there, it binds people, it brings them together. But they also discovered that you can have the same effect by singing another non-religious beloved song in a communal experience. And I think in this example might lie the answer to our question. Do we have to lie to ourselves or other people to do the meaningful things that we do for each other? Human touch and compassion, empathy, listening, showing love, giving gifts, being charitable, those things, that's not a religious exercise, it's a human one. Do we really have to add all the backstory to it? I think probably not. I think we could actually produce those changes, that effect, without having to attach anything magical to it. That's kind of where I fall, for what it's worth.
Definitely. Sort of like just going to a country or a rock concert.
Yeah. Some of my favorite moments. So granted, I stood in church from the age of 5 onward until, you know, much later in life than I probably should have. And I would stand there, and as we sang, I would feel elation and goosebumps and euphoria. And of course, the people around me would say, ah, you're experiencing the Holy Spirit. And with nothing else to credit it to, I'm going to agree with them. I felt the Holy Spirit. I felt it move. And then I discovered that I could have similar experiences through purely secular music, art, sex, drugs, all sorts of things, similar qualities of experiences, even if they're not identical. And it's why some of my, like if you watch something like Live Aid or some massive concert where, you know, a huge song is being sung from the stage, but this crowd of 20 to 50,000 is also singing along. When Freddie Mercury's got the entire audience in his hand and getting them to do whatever he wants, or when Bono was doing Bad and then adds other songs in it and gets the songs, I feel that, and I wasn't even there. Imagine how it would feel if you were there. Like, I can sit here right now and just go, wow, that's just awesome. It's amazing. And so it's not surprising that we feel stuff like that in religious contexts. It's just not the religion that's doing it. It's who we are as human beings and how music affects us. So.
I watched a debate that you did, and towards the end of the debate, you did the, I want to live in a world, blah, blah, blah. I want to live in a world that, and just reeled off a whole bunch of examples. And to be honest, I was, quote unquote, I guess the Matt Holy Spirit that I received when I heard you just reel those off.
I kind of remember that. So one of the things is I don't tend to write the things that I'm saying most of the time. I don't have a script for videos. I never have a script for the show. And quite often I don't have a script for debates. I'll have some opening remarks, and what I'll do is I'll jot down some other stuff. And I remember that closing remark. I don't remember which debate it was, but the closing remark, I remember writing ahead of time. So that wasn't fully spontaneous. I wish I could remember what debate it is, because it might be worth clipping out and sharing, but it's,
if you find the link, send it to
someone
us.
Someone put something together today, or I saw today, where they had a bunch of news clips where they zoomed in it and your voiceover was in the background of, I want to live in a world where XYZ.
I'd love to see that and share it. I'd love to see that and I'd love to share it, except that I don't want this show to be, oh, what's the coolest thing Matt ever said? And can we put it in? I want to get on to some other callers and see if we can help some people today. But yeah. I greatly appreciate your call, Absolutely. Matthew, and I hope that you you find a way to, you know, share the whatever time your father has left in a way that's positive and beneficial to both of you, even if you ultimately don't come out.
Correct. All right. Well, I appreciate you taking my call.
Yeah. Thanks a lot.
Yeah. Matt doesn't prepare. Like I'm meticulously manicuring every syllable of a speech. And we're going to a gig or a convention. Matt's like, oh, you know, yeah, I got some ideas. Oh, it'll be great.
It works. It's not always great. It works. Sometimes I screw it up. Sometimes I've been incredibly disappointed with what I've had to say, but it's more troubling for like event organizers, because they want to put together a program and they want to say, hey, come see Seth Andrews, where he's talking about, you know, and then whatever, the title of the talk is, you know, God blinders, or Christianity made me talk like an idiot, or One of my favorites, the Satanic Panic, but then there was also the one where Christianity steals everything from everybody. You've done some great stuff, and I've watched you both prep and deliver, and I've watched you deliver the same talk several times, you know, as we're touring around. And your diligence and the way you do it is great. I just can't work that way. I have to just have some notes and go.
Pull that off, it's pretty good. Can I throw out a hypo? I know you got a full switchboard, but
sure.
Here's a hypothetical, and this relates to the last caller, because I've had this conversation in my own life. Like my devoutly religious parents, who are terrified of their apostate son going to hell, etc., and feel tremendous shame and blah, 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 and would love to see me come back to the faith. Like, they're both very much in the winter of their lives. I've asked myself this question. I'm not exactly sure as a humanist what the right or what my answer would be. But let's say that time comes and dad has just a few days left. And he was in a moment where he needed comfort. And he begged me to say the salvation prayer with him. And it was just him and me in a room. Okay. Would I go through those motions lying to him to give him comfort in the final hours of his life so that he wouldn't die feeling aggrieved and terrified for his son whom he loves? Or would that be a sellout of my values, and the right move would be to say, no, I'm not going to say the salvation, even as a lie, even as an act, as theater for him and no one else. I won't do it as a matter of principle. And I don't know what the answer is to that question. I've navigated it in my own life. I can't decide what would the moral, the compassionate thing to do be. If I toss that out to you, Matt, do you have any thoughts on that one?
Yeah, it's something I've dealt with many, many times. And I think we talked about it like a week or two ago, in the sense of, you know, when I remember talking about it last week, when my grandmother was dying, I toyed with the idea of, oh, if she wanted me to tell her that I believed in God, would I lie to comfort her on her way out of life? And I can't say for sure what I would do, but I'd like to think that I would continue being honest. She knows that I don't believe. Well, she doesn't know anything anymore because she's dead, but she knew that I didn't believe. And I think that she loved me whether I believed or not, and I loved her whether she believed or not. And I think that I would like to have had a moment where I don't think she'd ever ask or expect it, but I know she appreciated the fact that I was honest, and she knew that I was honest and good. And that was enough for her mostly. Any other damage that was being done to her psyche about the fact that I'm not a believer, that came from her religion. And I think I would probably have said something along the lines of, if there's an afterlife, I hope that I get to spend it playing cards with you and doing fun things with you. I don't think that's the case, and I will miss you dearly. And you're my favorite grandmother, that type of thing. Because she was.
I don't know. It's just a theoretical exercise that I've gone through. I actually started, I think, thinking, oh yeah, hell, I'd do whatever if it was just him and me and no one else in the room and there was no consequence. But over the last several years, I've drifted more into, why does everybody, I would never ask him to reject his God on my deathbed. Like, I would never make that demand.
Yes. So isn't that weird?
You know, I part of me thinks, you need to be yourself, live on your terms through and through.
And you have to think of it. If, for example, if my grandmother knew that I not only don't believe in a God, but I think that religions are making claims that are false and harmful, and I view them in the same category, metaphorically, as like cancer or debilitating drugs. Now, why would my grandmother on her deathbed say, hey, honey, I really hope you get cancer? Or would you please go start your heroin addiction now so that you can be like, that's just something that shouldn't happen. And I get it. I now have a completely different way of looking at religion than my grandmother or my parents or other people. But once you get, it's like the same thing we talked about with the blood magic ritual stuff. When you're in it, you can't see it. And when you're out of it, you can't stop seeing it.
Well, forgive the digression. I was just going to toss that out. I'm sure the comment section is going to have a heyday with this particular subject.
All right. So we've got RJ in Denver. You're on with Seth and Matt. How are you?
Hi. And I think I've talked to you before, Wes, a few weeks ago. I don't know if you remember me or not.
We'll find out. I take a lot of calls, okay. So I don't want to say I do before I do.
All right. Well, I know you've got the notes there, but basically, once again, this isn't 100% proof, but I think it definitely supports the idea of Judeo-Christianity over evolution.
I have a question, though.
The ancient...
Yep. So when you say it's not 100% proof, allow me to be kind of pedantic for a second in order to throw off the people who are watching this video and in chat who are going to be pedantic. Proof for me is a mathematical thing. Instead, when we're talking about epistemology, about how we know what we know, we don't have proof. That's math. What we have is evidence and whether or not the evidence is sufficient to reach a conclusion. So it's not like you have to have 100% proof. What you have to have is evidence that's sufficient to reach a conclusion. And so is the evidence that you're going to be presenting sufficient to conclude that a God exists?
I would say it definitely proves that atheism or evolution doesn't exist. Because if you look at...
Hang on.
Can I just say that I believe before we get into this philosophical argument? I just want to hear how you'd refute it.
Well, I mean, you've already... I don't want to be a dick. I'm going to let you say what you think. But you've already started off just about as awfully as you possibly could. You suggest that you have evidence for God. And then when I ask you about it, what you then say is that you think that it shows that evolution or atheism can't be correct. Well, atheism isn't a positive statement. And evolution isn't in any way necessarily excluding a God. And evolution by means of natural selection is the scientific cornerstone of the explanation for the diversity of life. Are you saying that you don't believe that evolution is real?
I don't believe in evolution.
Well, he just invoked Francis Collins, right, who actually is a Christian. Right. Ken Miller is an intelligent design guy who's also a credible biologist. You've got the Catholic Church, who it took them until the 1980s, but they finally embraced the fact of evolution, this idea that you've linked God belief and the science of evolution together.
Which is a mistake.
A lot of believers actually hold to evolution.
So prove evolution is false and undermine all of science. Go ahead.
Well, okay.
All biology.
The ancient civilizations, I think you would all agree, the oldest civilization is Sumeria that we know of, correct? Sumeria, ancient Sumeria.
And I don't know, but I'll go ahead. I don't know how that, I don't, see, here's the thing.
It's one of the oldest on record. I'll give him that.
I've been doing this a long time, and this is not the way that an argument is constructed. Like, genuinely, it's not like you're anywhere near a premise yet, other than to suggest, like, which ancient civilization is the oldest is irrelevant to whether or not there's a God. But go ahead.
Okay, so I know a lot of evolutionists believe that the humans started in Africa, right?
Can we just call them scientists? Can we just call them scientists and not evolutionists? Because we're talking about actual scientists who are actual experts in this. Who've spent their entire life doing this, and you want to evolutionists? But go ahead.
Sure. I mean, if you want to refer to them as that, that's. I mean, I don't.
I prefer to refer to them as realists attached to reality who aren't denying scientific facts. But you can call them whatever you want.
And I don't know that believe is necessarily the word that we find useful here. It is that it has been traced. We have traced humankind's lineage. We have traced it back to Africa. So it's not that they just woke up and said, I'm going to believe this. They actually dug into it and they began to reverse engineer the genome and began to look at civilizations and humankind. And
do you DNA is real?
Wait. Some of them believe Australia, though. So, do you believe Australia is where they started?
That's the first I've heard of Australia.
So, can we just stop, RJ? Because it doesn't matter. The fact that we don't know where life originated, the fact that scientists have a number of different speculations about that ultimate answer, doesn't mean that what we know about science is wrong. Do you believe that DNA is real? Because I had a caller today that didn't. So, I wanted to check that.
Yeah. I heard that. Yeah, and DNA is very, very complicated. It's a code. It's basically a codex. I mean, you used to be a coder, correct? Weren't you a coder for video games at one point?
It's not a code. It is analogous to a code, but it's not a code. It's not like somebody picked these out and constructed that. But you at least believe that DNA is real then?
Well, Yeah, it's a code. I mean, life wouldn't exist without it. It's a code.
It is not this. You saying it's a code is a dishonest way to address it. It is analogous to a code. It can be appear to be a code. But when somebody like you wants to use the word code with it, you're suggesting that this means that it was designed and implemented by an agency with an intent and purpose. And that's not how it applies with science to a DNA as a code.
Okay. Well, I think I'm getting off track here with the DNA. I just wanted to go into this, and I know you're probably going to disagree with it, but I just wanted to go into the civilization part of it and finish my thought on that.
Yes,
if you don't mind.
Distracting.
Okay. Okay. So the ancient civilizations, you have Sumeria, the one that we know of, the one that's on record, right? That's right smack dab in the Middle East, where a lot of people can, a lot of the religious, I should say, or Christianity theologians, not all of them, but some of them believe that that's where the Tower of Babylon was at. And it's very close. I mean, if you look back at the Noah, where he landed in Mount.
I think you mean Tower of Babel, not Tower of Babylon.
Yeah, Tower of Babel, but it became the... Yeah, it's the Tower of Babel, but then Babylon eventually came from that same section, but that was at a later time. That's why they actually referred to it as Babylon, but anyways, that was later. You're right. You're correct. But the Tower of Babel, correct. So all those civilizations, if you look at Greece, Egypt, and Sumeria, they're all right there in the Middle East. They're not in Africa. They're not in Australia.
Yeah. Okay, stop. RJ, stop. The oldest civilization, okay, that's what we're talking about, right? The oldest civilization, right?
Oldest known civilization, I should say, yep.
Oldest known civilization, but the key word there is civilization. You're not citing where did life begin, you're citing where did civilization, where did recorded history begin. Life predates recorded history. And when scientists say that life, our common ancestors for humans, seems to begin in Africa or in that vicinity, that's not saying that's where civilization began. The beginning of the existence of humans is not the same thing as the beginning of the existence of civilization.
Right, I understand that. So, but wouldn't the probability be more that it would, if life began in Africa, that civilization would have started roughly like in that area versus the Middle East, if that was correct?
So first of all, RJ, have you looked at a globe ever in your life? Do you think that the Earth is round or flat?
Yes.
Okay. So have you?
Are you going to insult me? Because yes, of course I think it's round.
Am I going to insult you? You're sitting here suggesting that biological science isn't real, and you think I'm insulting you?
I never said that biological science wasn't real. When did I say that?
You don't accept evolution, and you're pointing to the oldest civilization that you can reference and trying to argue as if that has any bearing on where life began or the origin of human beings began. And by the way, the Middle East and Africa, not that far away. And if you were to go to like 23andMe or do some genetic research, the haplotype there would show how our best understanding of human origins begin in a part of Africa, and then how your ancestors in particular migrated. In my case, it went directly through the Middle East and then up to Europe. But the beginning of humans is not the same as the beginning of civilization. And yes, if humans began in Africa, it's not surprising that we would see civilization in the Middle East.
Right.
Okay.
Another thing is the population, and I talked about this last time. Population, the highest population is in Asia, in the continent of Asia. It's not in the continent of Africa or Australia.
Oh my God.
Human life.
All right, I'm going to mute. I'm going to put you on mute, RJ. Where the largest population is today has no bearing on where human life originated. You might as well be saying that because New York has way more people than Maine, that clearly the first colonists landed right at New York and just built that there. If you're going to make the claim, all I want to know is, do you have evidence? And it says here that you have evidence for a high probability that Judeo-Christianity, which, by the way, isn't a fucking thing. Judeo-Christianity, not a real fucking thing. There's Judaism, there's Christianity. And the only time that Judeo-Christian, go ask a Jew if there's Judeo-Christian. That's only used when they want to side together against somebody else. But the origin that you're talking about, do you actually have evidence for it? Not, hey, look at the oldest civilization or look where the population is. That flies in the face of my personal confused interpretation of what science has to say about the origins of biological diversity.
Yeah, I heard a beeping noise. Am I still on the line?
I'm waiting for you to answer.
Okay. I would say that the fact that the Sumerian language is the oldest written language, I would say that that is in the Middle East. That makes the probability very high that life began or started in the Middle East.
Well, you're wrong. You are demonstrably wrong. That is your personal suspicion, which isn't supported by evidence or understanding and flies in the face of what scientists have seen. The reason you have that as the oldest written language and the oldest known civilization, that's because language goes along with what we define as civilized, but it doesn't go along with what we define as the origin of humans.
What about the early Sumerian religions that were not Christianity? That's what I'm wondering. Hmm. All right, let's say if we followed your premise to its logical conclusion, what about the non-Christian religions, right? These sort of heathen practices, these non-Jesus, non-Yahweh religious practices linked to the Sumerians, that would make your Judeo-Christianity bogus and false. You know, Jesus would have been a false prophet.
I knew you were going to bring that up.
Did you?
Well, I mean, I'm just curious. Yeah. How would you respond if we followed your premise to its natural origin and we say, fine, everything's rooted in ancient Sumeria, wouldn't the religions of that time and geographic region then be the accurate ones, plural, and not Judeo-Christianity, which came thousands of years later?
No. When Noah landed in Mount Ararat, which was north,
I'm done.
As kind of northern Syria, right?
Hands are up.
I know you don't believe in the Bible, but if you follow the actual stories.
RJ, you're now muted, and you're muted because my co-host said that he's done with you.
I mean,
he asked you about the logical conclusion of your argument, and what you came back was when Noah landed on Mount Ararat. First of all, you have no evidence that Noah existed or created a boat or that there was a global flood or that he landed on Mount Ararat or that anybody...
He just invoked, like, the most easily refuted story, arguably, in the Christian Bible.
But is that surprising? Or somebody who wants to, who thinks, somebody sitting there, armchair, deciding, confused about the difference between the origin of life, the origin of humanity, and the origin of civilization, thinking that he has evidence for a God, and then when faced with the logic that exposes that, well, of course we're going to go to Noah. RJ, you're not going to convince us by citing Bible stories. You need to come with evidence. I was waiting for you to say goodbye.
I have one more thing I want to say.
No, I was waiting for you to say goodbye.
Oh, okay. So
goodbye.
All right. I produced a video years ago. It's called Noah's Ark, God, Giraffes, and Genocide. And it, in about 4 minutes, just dissects the Noah story. Now, this is a digression from his original question, but he brings up Noah. I'm like, of all of the stories, like some of the shit in the Bible, we can be like, well, did it happen? Did that region do this or that? Well, you know, maybe. And then somebody sort of bastardized it and did something else with it and molded it and magicked it and did all those things, you know, magicked. That's not even a word. And
I'm with it. That's a word.
Noah's Ark. And so anyway, you can look that up on YouTube, but he said something else and it brought up a something I wanted to toss out. He mentioned the Tower of Babel. I produced, I think it was earlier this year, a short form audio vignette podcast. It's called The Tower That Reaches the Heavens. And it got into the story of the Tower of Babel, right? Prideful humankinds built the tower because they wanted to become God, essentially. They were reaching up into the heavens, and so they, using these primitive materials, primitive techniques, built this tower, and God got so pissed off that he punished the people by splintering them into languages that could not be understood, and then they all flew out. And so that's supposed to explain the various languages of planet Earth. But I was thinking to myself, you know, that story makes no sense. When he brought it up, I wanted to jump into that because I think the tallest buildings of the modern day so eclipse anything that the Tower of Babel might have ever been. You know, if you go to Dubai, or if you go to Kuala Lumpur, if you go to, hell, you look at One World Tower, and you look at the sheer height and girth and monumental amazingness of these structures, far eclipse anything that angered God in the Old Testament whenever the people were building Babel. And yet we've heard not one peep, not one syllable of protest from Yahweh over our hugely taller and more magnificent man-made structures in the 20th and 21st centuries. I just thought that was interesting.
So you and I are going to disagree.
Oh, shit. What'd I say?
Just a little bit, because I've also done a video about the Tower of Babel. And I would have agreed with you and thought, and it would agree with everything you said for the entirety of my time as a Christian, even having read it, until I actually read it and focused on it. Because the truth about the Tower of Babel story, and it's only 9 verses. I mean, it's Genesis 11, the first 9 verses, I think. And if you read it, actually, let me pull it up. Let me go to Bible Gate.
No, you don't have to read it to me. I'll take it on faith. I mean,
oh my God.
I believe it's true. You know, you don't have to.
So Genesis 11.
I'm being corrected on live television.
No. It's not corrected. Is it? Well,
if I'm wrong about the context or the text itself, I definitely want to know. So tell me where you're at.
At no point does it suggest that they were trying to build a tower to reach heaven or to be to reach God. At no point does it say God was in any way concerned or mad about the tower or concerned that it could reach heaven, which would be preposterous anyway. What it says is, in verse 1, now the whole earth used the same language and the same words. Cool. We know that's bullshit already. So this whole story is done from the beginning. We know enough about linguistics to know that that's not the case. But verse 2, it came about as they journeyed east that they found a plain in the land of Shinar and settled there. Okay. Then they said to one another, come, let us make bricks and burn them thoroughly. And they used bricks for stone and they used tar for mortar. Now, first of all, we're talking about a brick construction. So I'm sure we'll get engineers letting us know what can and can't be done.
What height and girth you could support, sure.
And they said, come, let us build a city, build for ourselves a city and a tower whose top will reach into heaven. And let us make for ourselves a name. Otherwise, we will be scattered abroad across the face of the whole earth. And then we get to the crux of this. In verse 5, it says, the Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the sons of men had built. The Lord said, behold, they are one people, and they all have the same language. And this is what they begin to do. And now nothing which they purpose to do will be impossible for them. Come, let us go down there and confuse their language so that they will not be able to understand one another's speech. In verses 5, 6, and 7, God comes down and says, hang on, these people are working together. They are communicating. They are working together. They want to stay together as a community. And if they keep doing this, there is nothing that they will be unable to accomplish. That is a direct paraphrase. And this is what they begin to do. And now nothing which they purpose to do will be impossible for them. Come, let us go down and confound their language so that they will not understand one another's speech. So the Lord scattered them abroad over the face of the whole earth, and they stopped building the city. Therefore, it was named Babel because the Lord confused the language. But the truth of the matter is, that story is about a group of people who were advocating for communication, cooperation, and principles of humanism. And God came down and said, if this shit keeps going, they're going to be able to do anything, and we can't have that.
But you just validated my position that it caused him great chagrin, which is why he confused the people and scattered them to the wind.
Right. Not because they were going to build a tower to heaven, though, but because they were cooperating and they would have no more need of God.
I buy that. I mean, I should have been clearer. I think I see the two tied. It's a cooperative endeavor, but you're right. It was more about the attitudes of the people and the idea that they could produce these amazing results without divine intervention. God was not pleased. But
can you imagine what would happen if they were building a spaceship?
Yeah, we have breached the end of the solar system, and yet Yahweh has not lifted a finger. He's not shown up and said, hey, wait a minute. This kind of cooperation ain't working for me. The International Space Station, right? Talk about global cooperation. Yahweh has not once said, hey, hang on, you can't do that.
Google Translate, motherfucker.
what was the term that you used?
And we
earlier?
Beat that too. What's that?
You used a term with a caller. You called it Google Foo.
Google Foo, yes. Your ability to type the correct phrases into a search engine to get the results that you're looking for.
There's also another, for the snarky people in the audience, if there's ever someone who is not able to procure the most basic of information and you want to make a point, there's a website called Let Me Google That For You. And you can go to that website and type in whatever the subject is. And then you can send your friend or family member that link. And it pops up and says, hey, let me Google that for you. And then it takes them to whatever the subject matter is. It's not for everybody. But if you're a little snarky, you might enjoy it.
I've done it. Let's. We've got Andrew in Oregon who wants to talk about Native religion beliefs. You're on with Seth and Matt. How are you? Whoops. Andrew? All right, I'm going to put Andrew back in the queue just in case he's been on hold for like an hour and a half, so I didn't want to lose it. Kevin in the Philippines, you are on with Seth and Matt. How are you?
Hello?
All right, we're going to return Kevin back to the queue in Philippines. Jonathan in Houston, Texas. How are you? I have no idea what. We're going to return you back to the queue. We went on a tangent for so long that all the people who are on hold went off.
Sorry, I tend to, like, I had Matt over. I don't know, you were going through town and you were here. And so we just set a camera up. And I'm like, hey, let's just talk for a few minutes. And it was like an hour, hour and a half. That shit happens. That's probably my fault as much as anybody.
So. I love the fact that you think it's your fault.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, you don't give a short answer. Like, I thought I was bad.
I am the king of talking for days.
No.
So Jessica in Vermont, how are you? You're on with Seth and Matt.
Hi.
How you doing?
Doing good. Doing good. I feel really privileged to talk to both of you. I like both of you so much. You've taught me a lot.
Thank you. Thank you. That's
the only one you should like. Let's fix that.
Well, I'm sure you probably have like in front of you what I talked to the guy that answers all of the calls before you guys. But I'm going to try to, like, not get emotional because this is very emotional for me.
I want to caution you real quick, Jessica. There is a chance. I've heard rumors. I know what you're going to talk about a little bit. There is a chance I've heard from other people that YouTube has been shutting down videos that in any way address what we're going to be addressing. So maybe this won't be able to be aired, but I may have bad information. So please go ahead and if it doesn't make what is ultimately lives forever on YouTube, at least we will have tried to have a discussion and help out.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, I kind of just am looking for advice on how to deal with my parents, my Seventh-day Adventist parents. And they think the world is ending, of course. And see, I'm starting already.
All right. That's all right. Just be real. Don't apologize for emotion if it comes through. You're doing great.
It doesn't matter. We can skip whatever COVID stuff that they may be thinking is ending the world. Just the important thing is that you're...
Well, that's what it is.
Yeah. But that's the thing that I don't want to talk about.
Yeah. I mean, of course, because of everything that's going on with COVID, they do. They think that this is the end of the world and that Jesus is going to come back, you know? And because of that, they have been working overtime on trying to make sure that my 7-year-old daughter is going to go to heaven. And I don't know how to deal with them because I don't want to give them an ultimatum. I love my parents. I love them so much. And I love my kids so much. They've been there for me through thick and thin. And I don't want to tell them, you can't see your granddaughter and your grandson unless you stop doing this. But, like, they were here this weekend. They brought Jesus books. That's what my dad calls them. He brought Jesus books. And he read stories to her all weekend, and she is getting in over her head because if I try to mention to her that, you know, it's, that there are probably parts to it that aren't real or that they're just stories and stuff, she gets very upset with me and, you know, starts crying and telling me that I'm lying and everything. And I don't know how to deal with this.
Jessica, this is going to be mildly tough love. I can't give advice to someone if their position is, I don't want to tell my parents not to do something, because the only advice that I can give you at this point is that that's exactly what you have to do. You have to set up boundaries around your life and around your daughter's life, and your parents either respect those boundaries or they don't. If this is in fact, if they are undermining your ability to parent and are being disruptive, when you're trying to teach your daughter responsibly how to look at these stories in a different way, that's a big deal. However, you may already be in too far. I want to find out what Seth thinks about all this, but you may be in too far, because if your daughter likes when grandpa reads her stories about this stuff and finds it interesting, you may just have to kind of allow that so that you don't end up with, you know, a sort of rebellion dismissal of your views. You shouldn't. It's about teaching them how to think more than what to think. You can, if you do it right, and show that you're supportive and that you don't believe this stuff, but, you know, hey, you should learn about it or whatever else. You can set up ways teaching her about other religions as well is a good way to perhaps help inoculate her. I don't know if Seth's got extra stuff here.
I mean, that's a tough one. It hurts my heart. You know, you can hear it in her voice. There is a familial consequence that keeps a lot of people from breaching this with moms and dads and siblings and spouses, because, you know, if I hold the line, then they may disappear, or I may have to disappear them from my life, and I love them and I don't want to do life without them. I want them to have grandparents, my child to have grandparents, and, you know, there's this weird familial blackmail that kind of happens, whether or not they intend to hold it over you. But I just grieve at the idea that you and your daughter are cheated out of an authentic life because someone else can't observe boundaries. There's this weird parental permission that happens sometimes. Parents will say, well, this is not how we raised you. So they somehow tell you that, you know, this is how you're supposed to live, and this is who you're supposed to marry, and this is how you're supposed to worship, and this is how you're supposed to vote. And if you don't do those things that we have prescribed for you, then we failed as a parent. How could you have failed us? We failed you. It's a failure all around, you know. And it hurts my heart to hear about it, but Matt's right. You are very much in the right when it comes to drawing a line, a boundary, and saying, you're not going to parent my child. And I think it's important that my child know what you believe and that you believe. I think that's just fine.
Well, ask them how they would feel while they were raising you, somebody else in the family who was, for example, Catholic or Hindu, were trying to teach you their religion as if it were true. Ask them how they would respond to somebody undermining their parenting that way.
Well,
that's a really good point.
And I think the idea that they get to do this because they're on the family tree, or because, you know, you are our daughter, and I get that they're concerned for the child's immortal soul and all that. But I think to me, this causes us such emotional pain that we often will allow things we normally would not allow. And I sense that in you, right?
Yeah. I mean, because all the way up until everything started happening with COVID, if my two kids went down to their house and stayed for the weekend, which would happen once every couple of months or whatever, they would bring the kids to church. And my husband and I were always like, you know, whatever. It's not a big deal. They did the same thing. I have two older children. They did the same thing with them. And both of those older children are atheists. And my 20-year-old is actually the one who opened my mind to how religion is such a farce. And so I always was just kind of like, oh, you know, they're fine. But now that everything's been going on with COVID, it's like they are just going out of control with it. It's like every time I turn around, they're talking to her about it. They're reading things to both of them about it. I'm just like, what in the world is going on?
Yeah. Let me jump in, Jessica, real fast. And I'm not Yoda on this, okay? But I've got a perspective because I was an indoctrinated kid, right? And I get it.
Yeah.
I think with your child, I think your child needs to know what your parents believe. Hey, you know, they believe this with all of their heart. Here's what they believe. I don't agree. And I think you need to be honest about your own journey. And here's why I don't agree. And here are, and Matt's right, teach them some other religions, show them some other faith traditions. And then another interesting exercise might be to take some examples. Hell, I got a whole chapter called This is the End in my book, Sacred Cows, that just goes through all of the failed end of the world predictions, a lot of the major ones over the past 2,000 years. You know, honey, back in the year 500, this happened. And back when the Black Plague happened, people said it was the end of the world. And back when this happened, 9/11 happened, people thought it was the end of the world. And every generation has had people who thought that at any moment, people have been saying that Jesus is coming back for 2,000 years.
I remember when I was a little girl, you know, my dad and my mom were telling me all the time, you know, it's going to be the end of the world any day now, any day now.
It was in the New Testament.
The time growing up.
It was asserted in the New Testament. There were some among you who will not see death. The implication was that Christ was going to return in the lifetime of some of the disciples.
Right.
That was 2,000 years ago. And so I think what this does is it provides an opportunity for discovery. You're not telling your child, well, this is a bunch of bullshit. What you're saying is, hey, take a look at some of these other instances where people have freaked out. And it never happened. Show him Harold Camping, who was wrong four different times on the end of the world and Jesus returning. And I think if you give the child examples and make it part of a journey, that is going to produce more fruit and better results. And it will also produce in your child a sense of ownership when they come to the conclusion on their own that, you know what? Grandpa and grandma may really believe that it's the end of the world, but a lot of these other people, they got it totally wrong. Maybe they do as well. That's a starting point. I don't know if that has any usefulness or utility for you or not, but that's kind of where I fall.
There are exercises you can do. I know Russell Glasser used to recommend quite often playing a game about how you tell the difference between what's fantasy and what's reality. How do we know dinosaurs are real and insert fictional unicorns aren't? I was going to go with something to Christmas, but just in case somebody's kids watching, I don't want them to hear me say something. Oh, shit. Never mind. Having fun because there's one more call I want to get to before the end of the show. And I think.
Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate you guys.
Jessica.
Yeah.
Give yourself permission to set boundaries. All right. There's no guilt. Okay. There's no shame. If they freak out, that is not on you. You can do your best to work through it. But
let them know.
They are the ones who've stacked this deck.
Right.
Give yourself permission to set boundaries. It's okay to do
that. And let them know you still love them. This isn't you hate your parents or you still love them.
Right.
This is about how you are going to be raising your kid and what involvement other people are going to take. And if you can frame it to them that way, maybe you'll find that it's not quite the end of the world with regard to teaching your daughter.
Hang in there.
Right.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jessica. And reach back out and let us know how it goes. And we'd love to hear more when you get that. Last call for today is someone who we had asked to call back. And I appreciate the fact that Seth and all the crew and everybody are staying a little bit late because I wanted to hear and check in with Mary in Minnesota. How are you, Mary?
I'm good. How are you doing?
I'm having a better day than I thought I was going to when it started. So I'm happy you called I appreciate your patience.
Sure. Well, you guys are both two of my favorite heathens. I listen to both you guys all the time. My only complaint about you both, though, is you could put out more content.
Oh, my God.
I'm overwhelmed as it is. By the way, Mary, I just wanted on the record that I'm glad I'm not the only one on the broadcast with a biblical name. Actually, Matthew is a biblical name, but normally, being an atheist with the name Seth is always like it's just an odd phenomenon. But I saw the Mary and I was
Noah.
A lot of people say, oh, you must be a good Christian girl. And I'm just like, well, not really. So, I had called in February and talked to Matt and Daryl Ray.
Yes.
And I've been diagnosed with stage 4 pancreatic cancer. I'm still doing pretty well. My prognosis probably isn't as good as it was then, but I'm still pretty healthy. And I had a brother who was really struggling with things, and him and I have been having a lot of really good conversations. And so, you know, when they were talking about, you guys earlier today were talking about terminally ill patients, and, you know, I'm terminally ill, and, like, my kids spoil me rotten. Anything mom wants now, mom gets, which is pretty awesome, by the way. But, you know, I'm just like you are. You could die before me. Like, I found that people don't want to talk about death. They're afraid to. If I even say anything, some people are, like, say I would say, oh, I don't know if I'll be here at Christmas. They say, oh, you can't talk like that. You can't talk like that. And you know what? I'm not afraid to die. I'm not afraid to, I'm not afraid that I'm going to burn in hell or anything like that. So, like, I'm not afraid to talk about it at all, but everybody is.
You know, Mary, we had a call earlier in the show, and I don't know if you heard it, but there was a guy who was calling in because his father got a terminal diagnosis, and we were talking about whether or not, or to what extent religion was potentially pushing him to strive to continue living. And just for clarity on this, you know, because we spoke, what was it, back in February, I think it was?
I think so, yeah, I think.
Yeah. You know, you're terminally ill, and you're not afraid of dying, but you're also would prefer to continue living. And
sure,
is that, you know, what do you think about religion as a motivator to either keep people living or whatever?
I think it's all those prayers that you guys didn't say for me.
Mary.
What's your take? Matt's question.
You know what it is? It really is? It's just, it comes down to like your genetics, how your body responds to treatment. I try to be healthy. I try to eat healthy, but I still eat some junk food. Like, I feel pretty good still. I feel pretty strong still. I don't know if I have a month or 6 months. I really don't know. I don't think I'll be here. I'm pretty sure I won't be here a year from now, but, you know, I'm not at all afraid. And I wish I could convey how I feel to people that have so much fear of death. I mean, I know it's a survival instinct. We all have to have it to a certain degree, but and I feel lucky too. Like, people are like, oh, I'm so sorry. And it's like, I'm so glad that I didn't just get hit by a bus and boom, I was gone. I've had all this time. We've been off because of everybody being on furlough. I've had my kids with me. We've played board games. We've had campfires. I've been living my best life for the last 6 months. And this is a gift. I mean, that I get to find out that I have stage 4 pancreatic cancer and still have so many good days left.
It's a question we get.
I'm not afraid. What's that?
Sorry. I'm sorry, Mary. That's a question that we get asked a lot. And I don't mean we in the sense of the atheist experience. I mean, just people in general. If you had a terminal illness, would you want to know? And how would that affect your life? It's kind of one of those party questions or thought exercise game questions where you're getting to know people. And, you know, because some people would want to know and some people wouldn't want to know. I know that I am the type of person, or I'm pretty confident I'm the type of person who would want to know because I want to be able to make the best decisions I can. I know other people who wouldn't want to know. And to have someone like you and my friend Dave Warnock, who are both hitting this head on, and like every time you call, I can just hear in your voice a strength and confidence and comfort. I could only hope that I had a half of that if I ever actually.
But you would have it. You would, though. I honestly think that if I was on the other side of the fence where you are, okay? Like, if I was on the side of the fence where you are, because it's like I'm on a different side of the fence than everybody else now. Because I know. You don't know. I mean, you could die before me, but you don't know.
Right.
So I get to take advantage of that and go, hey, I want to spend as much time with my loved ones. I want to have some conversations with people I care about. There's things that I have had all this time to live life and enjoy life, and I have zero fear. And so, I mean, I really appreciate what you do, what Seth does. I mean, I've watched your broadcast and podcast, listened to them, both of you and many others, and that's what took away my fear. I have no fear. I mean, I don't want it to hurt, you know, and that's the only thing. Other than that, like, what is there to be afraid of?
Well, I tell you, Mary, please keep contacting us whenever you feel like it to give us updates on what's going on, because you are the type of person that I hope I would be in that situation. And I think a prime example, along with Dave Warnock and others, of a humanist, rational, skeptical mindset of how to face the greatest difficulty that could ever be put in your path. And I just, we love you to pieces. I love hearing from you about how well you, so please keep calling from time to time, to let us know how you're doing.
You're not going to escape it either. You're not going to escape it either. That's the thing. I'm not doing anything that everybody isn't going to do. We're all going to die someday. So why are we so afraid? Stop being so afraid, you know?
Do you inspire me, Mary? Do you inspire and encourage? That must be your gift in the Lord.
Oh, my God.
To inspire and encourage other people. Oh, no, in all seriousness, it's a tremendous honor to hear you say those words about the shows and that they provided encouragement for you. And I think you're a reminder to us, right? There may be no tomorrow, so say the words and love who you love and be who you are and live life on your terms and, you know, seize the day. And I thank you for that reminder.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Mary. I appreciate it.
Please
stay in touch.
I'll do that. Thank you.
Thanks.
I got goosebumps, man. I mean, she's just like, wow.
It's the reason that I wanted to go. I was like, the crew was like, you know, hey, we can go past six. And I'm like, well, I don't want to be disrespectful to Seth since he volunteered to come in and pinch it. And I was like, but we're definitely going to go a little past because there's no way I'm not going to take a call from Mary. I want to say, first of all, to Mary and to everybody else, I caught a glance in chat and, you know, the chat's incredibly supportive in talking about how much they love Mary and the call. I appreciate it greatly. If we can put the crew cam back up, these are the people who make my life better just in general. every one of them volunteers who are working to get ACA Productions out. As a couple reminders before we go, and that is if you were watching it live and you hadn't yet donated, you can donate. You could also come back and donate some other week up there at the top of the chat. I want to thank everybody who's supporting us on Patreon, everybody who's supporting us in YouTube as well. But at the end of the deal, even if, at the end of the day, even if there weren't, like, we're all volunteers here. And we're doing what we think is important. When somebody like Mary calls in, it both breaks my heart and restores my heart because here's someone who I would genuinely love to spend 5 years talking to, and yet that's unlikely. And I hope that for the people who tune in and watch this, who are fortunate enough to see weeks when Seth is here, when people who aren't on all the time are here to give their views on this, I hope that you guys benefit and appreciate, and that you go out into the world and try to make similar changes to other people's life. All of us need work, and all of us need help. And that's the reason that the Atheist Community of Austin exists. It's the reason that Seth and I are friends. It's the reason that I'm supportive of the Thinking Atheist and Seth in general. And I can't thank you enough for agreeing to fill in here last minute. I loved having you here. I would do it all the time if we could. Mary wants us to do it all the time, so maybe you and I should produce more content. Who knows?
And honestly, thanks for letting me play along. You know, I've always this is what, third or fourth time I've been on. I just love it. It's a great format. The audience is fantastic. I hope you get what you need from me when I'm here blathering on, but it's a real honor and I appreciate it. And I hope everybody stays safe and I look forward to the next time.
Okay. Absolutely. Last couple of reminders next week. Scott Clifton, otherwise known as Theoretical Bullshit, who I've been wanting to get on the show for years, will be here live on the Atheist Experience. For those who are concerned about Jenna, I'm looking forward to hearing her personal day. You know, hey, sometimes things happen and people need to take a day off. Still involved. We'll see her soon as well. And all of you, take care, especially in this global pandemic. Follow the instructions in your area with regard to staying safe and keeping other people safe as well. We look forward to seeing you next week. Thanks so much for tuning in. Bye-bye.